Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on the data that are redefining treatment paradigms for patients with triple-negative breast cancer. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. Hope Rugo, Neil Iyengar, Heather MacArthur, and Jason Mwabi will discuss the latest pivotal data informing the optimal strategies to manage patients with early-stage triple-negative breast cancer. This activity is provided by PER and supported by educational grants from AstraZeneca, Merck & Co. Inc., Daiichi Sankyo Europe GmbH, and BioNTech. In the first segment, Dr. Mwabi presents data to help guide neoadjuvant therapy for patients with early-stage triple-negative breast cancer.
So we're going to start with a case. Think about a 52-year-old woman that presents with a 2.5 centimeter grade 3 triple-negative breast cancer. Her Ki-67 is elevated at 90%. Germline testing was done, and it revealed a BRCA1 mutation. Now, the patient undergone staging workup that included the breast MRI that showed the primary tumor in the left breast with a single ipsilateral axillary lymph node that is morphologically abnormal. That lymph node was ultrasound guide biopsied, and it showed involvement. So she's clinical stage T2, clinical N1, M0. All right, polling question. For this patient, which neoadjuvant regimen would you choose? Would you choose the KEYNOTE-522 regimen, which is paclitaxel, carboplatin, pembrolizumab, followed by AC, pembro? Or would you choose dose-dense AC, followed by paclitaxel, carboplatin? Or would you use dose-dense AC, followed by paclitaxel alone? Or would you use NAPAC plus atezo, followed by AC plus atezo? Or would you choose neoadjuvant olaparib plus durvalumab? Or I would enroll this patient on a clinical trial.
Okay, so Jason, what would you do in this same situation with this patient?
I ideally always like to enroll my patient on a clinical trial if available, but if not available, I will do the standard of care, the KEYNOTE-522, the chemoimmunotherapy with pembrolizumab, carboplatin, paclitaxel, followed by AC pembro.
I think one question that comes up and is whether or not dose-dense AC followed by paclitaxel alone is even a standard of care for any patient now.
Yeah.
So now, show me the data.
All right. Let's do it. So this slide, usually I put it at the end of my presentation, but it never gets the spotlight, so I decide to put it at the beginning of my presentation. All right. So this is kind of the algorithm in terms of standard of care. That's something that I follow, but you don't have to follow, but this is kind of a guide for today's presentation. So for clinical T1 node negative, it's perfectly okay to take those patients for upfront surgery. Now, T1A, T1B node negative, we're going to talk about the data, but you can discuss the risk and benefit of going, of giving treatment or just observing those patients. Now, T1C node negative, this is where data starts stacking up to give those patients adjuvant chemotherapy, and you can give ACT. Now, in patient with the T2 or higher or any node positivity, again, chemotherapy for sure, but if they're BRCA mutated, you can consider also olaparib after the chemotherapy. Now, patient clinical stage 2 or higher, so clinical T2 or higher or N1 or higher, a standard of care is to go with neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy, the KEYNOTE-522 regimen, and then see what you get on the back end. If patient achieve past CR, right now standard of care dictates to continue pembrolizumab for those 9 more cycles if you give it every 3 weeks, or those 4 to 5 cycles if you give it every 6 weeks. Patient who have residual disease, however, they need further therapy. So you can do pembro CAPE, or if they have a germline mutation, you can do pembro olaparib. All right, so let's start first with those patients that are T1A, T1B node negative. There was a study done on the SEER database, large numbers, 8,000 plus patients. You can clearly see that in the T1A and the T1B, whether those patients receive chemotherapy or they just went on observation, they did about the same. So really, chemotherapy clinically didn't add this meaningful benefit to those patients. However, you can clearly see when you start looking at the T1C patients, you can see here the benefits start becoming much more prominent. And here you can see a delta or absolute benefit about 3.3% with a hazard ratio, adjusted hazard ratio of 0.64. Now let's talk about neoadjuvant treatment. Immunotherapy has really changed the whole landscape of that subtype in the neoadjuvant setting. And there are three studies that looked at that. The one that we're all familiar with because it changed practice is the KEYNOTE-522. KEYNOTE-522 looked at the addition of pembrolizumab to the chemotherapy backbone. So here, starting with paclitaxel carboplatin, then going on to an anthracycline cytoxan with pembrolizumab, and then patient goes for surgery. And then after surgery, if they received immunotherapy in the adjuvant setting, they continued it adjuvantly, or if they did not receive immunotherapy, they went on placebo. There was another study looking at immunotherapy in that setting, and that's the IMPASSION 031. Here, the differences between that and the KEYNOTE-522 is that they used a different immunotherapy. They used atezolizumab, which is unlike pembrolizumab. This is a PD-L1 targeted antibody. And also, different than the KEYNOTE-522 here, they used NAPAC instead of paclitaxel, and they did not include carboplatin. Now, the third and last study is the NSABP B59. It was also open in Europe under the name Jepardus. And here you can see this one also a little bit different than the KEYNOTE-522. It contained the same chemotherapy backbone. However, the immunotherapy here was also atezolizumab, not pembrolizumab. All right, let's move on. Okay, so if you look at PCR, when you look at the KEYNOTE-522 and the IMPASSION 031, you can see that both studies showed improvement of PCR. The KEYNOTE-522, it improved with a delta or absolute improvement of about 14%, close to 65% in the patient who received the immunotherapy. On the IMPASSION 031, the delta or the absolute improvement of PCR was even more prominent. You see here about 16.5%, close to 60% in the patient who received atezo. Now, when you look at the event-free survival and overall survival from the KEYNOTE-522, both were improved. So you can clearly see the event-free survival. If you look at the five-year mark, it improved by about a delta of 10%, the event-free survival, the overall survival with a delta or absolute benefit of around 5%. Now, this is something very important. You can see that the event-free survival is improved across so many different subgroup. So if you look at the stage 2 patient, because we always wonder, do those patients really need immunotherapy? Yes, there is an absolute benefit of 8.1%. How about node negative patient? Do node negative patient benefit from immunotherapy? Absolutely. Also a delta above 8% when you give immunotherapy versus no immunotherapy. And finally, those T2 node negative, also those we wonder whether immunotherapy benefit them. Yes, it does, with a delta of about 10%. Now, then the very important question is, because we know in the metastatic setting, based on the KEYNOTE-355, we only give immunotherapy if patients have a PD-L1 positive based on CPS score of at least 10%. How about the early setting? Should we care about PD-L1 expression? Clearly, what you can see is the benefit is across PD-L1 positive and negative patient. Patients who receive immunotherapy tend to get higher likelihood of achieving PCR. However, you can also see the higher the PD-L1, the more likely you're going to achieve PCR. I mean, patients with PD-L1 negative chances of PCR are below 50%, but you can clearly see patients with a CPS above or equal to 10, the chance of achieving PCR is close to 80%. But across the board, compared to no immunotherapy, immunotherapy improved the chance of achieving PCR. Now, the Jepardus study also looked at that. When I looked at the event-free survival, you can see it didn't really improve that by much. And especially when you separate the patient who achieved PCR versus those with residual disease, again, you can see it didn't do much in terms of improving long-term outcomes. However, when you look at subgroup analysis, something very interesting showed up over here is that if you stratify patient by node positive versus negative, there was a trend of improvement of long-term outcome, especially event-free survival, in the patient that are node positive. And that was statistically significant. But again, the study included node positive and negative patients. Now, the very interesting study, this is presented recently at San Antonio, This is called the Olympian study. So this study had two cohorts. All patients on that study needed to have a BRCA germline mutation, either BRCA 1 or 2. Now, cohort 1 of that study took patients with small tumors, T1b node negative or T1c node negative. And those patients went on to receive neoadjuvant single-agent olaparib for 4 to 6 cycles. Cohort B took a little bit of a higher risk population. So they took the T1N1 patients or T2N0 patients. Now, unfortunately, they only enrolled T2N0, as we can see in a little bit, but both were allowed to enroll. And here they gave them, on top of olaparib, durvalumab for 4 to 6 cycles. And then patient went for surgery and the primary endpoint was PCR. One of the main secondary endpoint was looking at the residual cancer burden. I mean, this is very impressive. I mean, look at cohort A. Cohort A had the T1b node negative and T1c node negative. I mean, look at this PCR, 70% PCR chance. And if you looked at RCB class 0-1, it was 72%. Truly impressive from single agent olaparib. Now, when you look at cohort B, this is the patients, again, T1 and 1 could enroll, also T2 and 0. All patients enrolled here were T2 and 0. I mean, this is very impressive. Look at this PCR rate. PCR rate with durvalumab olaparib, 80%. Better than chemotherapy can ever accomplish in those patients. And if you look at RCB class 0 to 1, you're about 85%. This is really exciting. Yes, small numbers, but this is definitely hypothesis generating. And this is very exciting to be studied on a larger study. All right. Now let's talk about the role of platinum. This has been very controversial for years. The largest study looking at that was the PEARLY study, which was a phase 3 study. Here they looked at giving patient AC followed by taxane or giving AC followed by a taxane plus carboplatin. Now here patient could have received this treatment as neoadjuvant treatment or as adjuvant treatment, and they were looking at event-free survival rate. So you can see here the event-free survival rate at 5 years. It improved from 75% to about 82%. So clear benefit of the addition of carboplatin to patients with early stage triple negative breast cancer. When you look at overall survival, it wasn't statistically significant. However, you can also see some separation of the curves in favor of the carboplatin arm. And this has been sustained, this benefit of the addition of platinum across all the subgroup of patients. All right. Now, there are other studies that looked at that. So we have a total here of 6 studies. All of them showed the same thing. The addition of carboplatin does improve disease-free survival, event-free survival, and in some instances, it did also improve overall survival. So clear benefit of the addition of carboplatin, especially in the triple-negative patients.
In the next segment, Dr. Moabi discusses the data for adjuvant therapy for patients with early stage triple negative breast cancer.
So we're going to continue our case one. So the patient did receive what we recommended, the neoadjuvant KEYNOTE-522 regimen. And then she went for surgery. She did a bilateral mastectomy. And at that time, when they looked at the pathological response or assessment, they found a 0.4 centimeter residual disease, so YPT1A, and the node has converted to YPN0. She did undergo radiation. Now, in terms of systemic therapy, what would you recommend? Would you recommend pembrolizumab for the remainder of 1 year, pembrolizumab for the remainder of 1 year plus olaparib for 1 year, because remember that patient was germline BRCA mutated. Would you give olaparib for 1 year, capecitabine, observation, or you would enroll on a clinical trial? Perfect. All right. So the majority will give pembrolizumab in combination with olaparib. I would have done the same. And we're going to talk about those data. But one more question before we move. Let's say this patient had a PCR. Would you continue the pembrolizumab? Yes, I would continue. No, I would not. All right. The majority, about 90%, would continue to pembrolizumab, 10% would not. All right, let's talk about the data in the adjuvant setting. So where did capecitabine come from? The capecitabine came from the CREATE-X trial, which was truly a study from Japan. And that study was not only for triple negative. It was for triple negative and ER positive. And here, patients received neoadjuvant treatment. And if they had a non-passed CR, they were randomized to either observation or to receive capecitabine for 6 to 8 cycles. In the overall population, there was no benefit. All right. But then when they looked at the triple negative group of patients, there was improvement in terms of both distant-free survival or recurrence-free survival and overall survival. Now, this is, we'll talk about in the discussion. I have a lot of reservation about that study. It is practice changing because at that time we had nothing else to give those patients, so we're glad to have an option. But whether or not it's truly useful, we'll keep it to the discussion. Now, the other one is for patients with BRCA1 and 2 mutation, and that's the Olympia trial. Now, the Olympia trial patient can receive olaparib, either even if they receive neoadjuvant treatment or adjuvant treatment. But basically, it took patients with stage 1 to stage 3. If they received neoadjuvant treatment and they were triple negative, any patient with any residual disease can qualify for that study, so for olaparib. Patient who went for upfront surgery, they can only receive olaparib if they're T2 or above or if they're not positive at the time of surgery. Now, that study truly showed improvement of outcome. It improved both overall survival and distant recurrence-free survival significantly. I mean, the delta for improvement of distant-free survival was close to 10%, and it was about 4% absolute benefit in terms of overall survival. Across all the subgroup, there was clear benefit of olaparib. Now, let's talk about the future a little bit. One of the studies that is looking at the future is looking at whether we can use a non-anthracycline backbone, and that's the SCARLET study. Now, to be eligible for the SCARLET study, you need to have a T2 or above a tumor. Now, if patients are T1, they need to be not positive. Here, patients were randomized to either get the current standard of care, with this, which is the KEYNOTE-522 regimen, or go on to just receive pembrolizumab in combination with carboplatin and docetaxel for 6 cycles. So no anthracycline, and then patient go for surgery. Now, patient who received that intervention arm B, if they were found to have passed CR at the time of surgery, they just continued the pembro to complete the year. But if they had residual disease, then they kept it to the MD discretion whether or not to give the AC portion on the back end and whether to give capecitabine. The primary endpoint is a breast cancer-specific event-free survival. The other study that's really exciting for me is this study over here, is the NeoTract. Because finally, we have a study that is putting TILs at the forefront. TILs are tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes. We keep talking about TILs, but we never showed that TILs can be used as a biomarker for therapy selection. That study is going to help us answer that. Because here, patients with high TILs, they will receive 4 cycles of the pembro in combination with carbo. Here they have docetaxel, but taxane basically. So the first part of the KEYNOTE-522, and then they get imaging. If imaging show complete clinical response, then patient can go for surgery. If it does not, then the patient get 2 additional cycles of this regimen that is anthracycline-free, pembro, carbotaxane, and then they go for surgery. Now, patient with intermediate TILs, they get the full course, 6 cycles of pembro, carbo, and taxane, and then they go for surgery. Now, patient with low TILs, those patients receive the full KEYNOTE-522 regimen before going to surgery. So this is a very important study because it can finally answer the question about TILs. Do TILs really can help us give less chemotherapy to our patients? But this is the era of antibody drug conjugates. And so many studies are looking at that. So first, let's look at the new adjuvant treatment. So we have the TROPION-Breast04. The TROPION-Breast04 is comparing the KEYNOTE-522 regimen to just giving datopotamab deruxtecan plus durvalumab. We have also the TROFUSE-032. So the TROFUSE-032 is looking at sacituzumab tiromotecan plus pembro, so trying to replace the anthracycline here, followed by giving carboplatin, paclitaxel plus pembro, And the comparator arm here is the reverse KEYNOTE-522. So they start with Pembro AC and then they go to Pembro Carbo Paclitaxel. But also there is two ADAPT studies. So ADAPT triple negative 3, this is for stage 1 disease. Here they're comparing the given neoadjuvant sacituzumab govitecan plus pembrolizumab to just giving sacituzumab govitecan. But they have for the patient with a little bit higher risk, this is the ADAPT triple negative 4. This is an adaptive strategy. So all patients, whether they go on the control arm or the study arm, they receive first the carbo, paclitaxel, pembrolizumab, so the first part of the KEYNOTE-522. Now, in patients who receive the study arm, if by 12 weeks, so after finishing part one, if they still have evidence of disease, that means they're non-complete clinical responders, then they go on to receive SG, so sacituzumab govitecan plus pembro. Now, in the adjuvant studies, there are also ADCs are coming here. So we have the optimized RD, which is also called the ASCENT-05. So here our patient received new adjuvant treatment, had residual disease at the time of surgery. Here they randomized adjuvantly to either receive sacituzumab govitecan plus pembro or receive a pembro plus minus capecitabine. Now, I know this is not a study about ADCs, but there is a sister study to the optimized RD called the optimized PASCR. That study is looking at patients who received new adjuvant treatment, had PASCR at the time of surgery, and here they are looking whether or not you can forego adjuvant pembrolizumab. So here the study is randomizing patients to continue pembro to finish the year of IO or observation. All right, let's go back to the adjuvant treatments. We have also the TroFuse-012. Here again, patient residual disease at the time of surgery. They're being randomized to either receive sacituzumab tiromotecan plus pembro or get pembrolizumab plus minus capecitabine. And lastly, the TROPION-Breast-03, which is a triple arm. So again, patients with residual disease here are randomized to either receive datopotamab deruxtecan plus durvalumab or just receive datopotamab deruxtecan or go on the standard of care, pembrolizumab plus minus capecitabine. So this is kind of a summary. So standard of care in this day and age for patients with stage 2, 3 disease is to receive chemoimmunotherapy as neoadjuvant treatment because it does significantly improve PASCR, event-free survival, and overall survival. We always would like biomarkers because definitely there are some patients that might not need immunotherapy and some that would need it. At this point in time, those biomarkers that predict response remain elusive, but we need them. Platinum agent do improve outcome. That's why they're included. And as I showed you, there were 6 studies that looked at that. Now, there are studies looking at after surgery what to do. So patient with PASCR, can we omit immunotherapy? We're going to see that from the optimized PASCR study. Patient with residual disease, will the addition of antibody drug conjugate to immunotherapy, will it improve outcome in those patients? It remains to be seen. And there are new neoadjuvant backbones being investigated, especially looking at anthracycline sparing approaches and looking at incorporating ADCs also in the neoadjuvant setting to try to replace the anthracycline.
In the next segment, the panel addresses some audience questions about managing patients with early stage triple negative breast cancer.
You know, we had a couple of cases that in patients who had germline mutations. Do you think that, you know, when we're starting out evaluating patients, everybody should have who has triple negative disease should have germline testing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I wouldn't just put it triple negative. I'm big about universal testing because now you have a therapy that you can give for patients with BRCA mutation, even if they are ER positive. And unless you cast a wider net to check everybody, you wouldn't know who can qualify for that therapy and who would not. So I hope we can get to a place where universal testing is the norm and not the exception.
What about DNA repair mutations that aren't BRCA1, 2, and PALB2? We're going to see at this meeting, of course, the abstracts are now out of prostate cancer data where they seem to be able to treat everybody and have benefit if they give them a PARP inhibitor, as you know, ATM, you name it, right? I mean, very interesting.
It is. We don't have in the early setting yet. We have from the metastatic. The data really is skewed toward the in breast, at least for patient with BRCA1, 2, PALB2. PALB2 for me, it always has to be included in all those studies. That's why the Olympian study, it bothers me that they did not include the PALB2 patients because it's in the name, you know, PALB2 is partner and locator of BRCA2. I mean, it's in the name that it's like a BRCA2 mutation. But also somatic A patient with BRCA1 and 2 might also benefit from PARP inhibitor, but the other mutation have not shown at this point in time with the PARP inhibitor that we have that they have a meaningful benefit.
Do you also test for everybody, you guys?
So I generally agree with that statement, and I do advocate for broad testing. I think the challenge is in those patients who may not have qualified or been high risk enough for, you know, an Olympiad approach, then, you know, perhaps that is not the population in whom we would offer a PARP inhibitor in our lower risk patients. So I suppose you could make the argument that you don't necessarily need to do germline testing in that population. I think there are many other reasons why we should offer universal testing. So I do generally lean that way.
Counseling and prevention, which are so critical.
Yeah, precisely.
You know, for a 80-year-old patient who has no family history, that doesn't make any sense, right? So I do think we need to be selective. So I'm not sure that I agree with the testing in all patients.
This is the Canadian versus American way, by the way. I just want to put the disclaimer over here.
US now for
this is not the first time we argue about testing.
So for me, I only order tests when I have a very clear idea about what I'm going to do with that information. So I don't do blanket testing just because it was criteria.
Same with next NGS, right? You have the same approach. Yeah.
100%.
So when you have a patient with a germline BRCA mutation and has residual disease, are you all using, you said you're using olaparib pembro first, right? And you don't give CAPE at all, right?
So the CAPE is a lot of the data from CAPE bothers me. One of them is there is a GICAM study from Europe that clearly showed capecitabine is only beneficial in one triple negative group of patients. These are the luminal AR patients. There was no benefit in the basal triple negative, what we usually see in the US. If you look at population studies, luminal AR is highly expressed in the triple negative in the Asian population. So that study, that's why I highlighted, it was from Japan. Now, they didn't show us the different classification of triple negative, right? But it always, in the back of my mind, did we really see the benefit because we're capturing mainly luminal AR patients? But if we put more basal, do we see it? Now, we did that study at MD Anderson in the metastatic setting where capecitabine didn't do anything, absolutely nothing for patient with basal triple negative. So at Anderson, it bothered us giving capecitabine.
You always say that for the basal, like triple negative, these are not the low key 67, slower progressing, often AR positive triple negatives. We always say that the PFS is the time to the first scan.
Yeah, for
sure. So, because they have progression as their best.
Yeah, and we were just actually having this conversation, so I'm going to make another anti-CAPE comment before you defend CAPE. And you know, my sentiment is very similar, and I wonder, and also the SWOG data calls into question the utility of capecitabine in the residual disease setting and for American populations. And so I wonder a little bit, and particularly in the setting of a germline BRCA mutation, I do feel that what's driving the potential resistance to chemotherapy is the DNA repair mechanism. And so I feel like after a patient has gotten Keynote and we've used a platinum agent, in addition to PARP or to immunotherapy, rather, where I would expect that combination to be highly effective, independent of a germline BRCA mutation, if you still have residual disease, I do feel that it's the HRD pathway that's likely driving the resistance.
I wish the carbo had worked better, you know, since it might target that pathway. But we have a question from the audience, which I think is one I was going to ask. So it's really well placed. I just had a patient who came in and said she only wanted to get single agent pembro for her neoadjuvant therapy for her triple negative disease. She's Chinese. She didn't want to get any chemo. She felt like, you know, there was a lot of mistrust there. Now, she did now agree to go on I-SPY, so it took a lot of talking. But if you have a patient who has a germline BRCA mutation and they say, I really want to get chemo, is there a situation where we'd use the Olympian type approach? Obviously, we don't have durvalumab approved in breast cancer, but would you give you'd have to get the drugs. So assuming that you could get the drugs, would you give olaparib and pembro or olaparib alone?
I mean, there was a study already that looked at neoadjuvant with talazoparib, right? It was from Dr. Jennifer Litton. It was we had it at MD Anderson, and we did see very decent PCR on that study. So it is an option that you can use, and there is data to back it up, and I would consider it.
Heather?
So we have a study that we're opening next month looking at stage one TNBC and reminding ourselves that in the first line TNBC setting, the response rate to immune therapy monotherapy was 25%, which is really impressive, actually. So if we've learned anything, that applying those strategies earlier on in course of disease, there could be a huge number of patients who have low-risk disease who don't require cytotoxic therapy. So we have a study looking at immune therapy alone that we're putting through approval right now that'll probably be available August, September for us. Josh Gruber has been the champion for this. Looking at immune therapy alone versus Taxol Carbo, which a lot of us are using for T1C disease, versus Taxol Carbo Pembro, which a lot of us are extrapolating. So we've been doing a lot of extrapolating, but we really need good data. So I'm excited that this study, I think, will really inform this space for stage one.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's great because I do think that we didn't talk about stage one TNBC much, but, you know, I think we don't have the data to support immunotherapy in smaller TNBC, higher PD-L1 expression, higher response to chemo. And we do see IRAEs, which I think complicate settings. So I think this kind of question is really important for the smaller tumors that generally are better actors. Not always, but mostly are better actors.
In the final segment, Dr. MacArthur discusses novel bispecific drugs that target both VEGF and PD-1 or PD-L1 to treat metastatic triple-negative breast cancer.
There are other co-directed drugs that are in development. You see two here. These are targeted to VEGF. So we had an approval back in the day with bevacizumab, which is a VEGF targeted antibody. Now this idea is coming back. The idea is that if you limit the vascular invasion to tumors, that you could prevent oxygen and nutrients traveling to those developing tumors. So there's a lot of interest in VEGF targeting agents together with PD-1 and PD-L1. So you see two antibody drug conjugates here with two different targets here, VEGF and PD-1 and PD-L1 respectively. And there are phase 3 trials that are ongoing in PD-L1 negative metastatic triple negative breast cancer looking at these bispecifics. And you see two examples here, Harmony BC1 and Rosetta Breast01.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.